Jesus save.
Mormon Mental Health is a production of Mormon Stories Podcast and the Open Stories Foundation. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards supporting its listeners. To support the podcast, please consider a donation today at mormonmentalhealth.org. And thanks for listening.
Jordan Compass.
You've shared so much of your own personal, you know, I think emotion and just your vulnerability with us here today. And I just want to point out how, you know, courageous I think that is. And I loved your story about sitting down with your daughter and explaining to her, you know, what was going to happen when the police came and why they were there. And even your thoughts about, you know, how do I start not only shifting my own individual, you know, journey in this aspect, but how do I become then an advocate for my children? And what you said about, you know, being an example to them and showing them appropriate ways of responding to these types of issues is such an important piece, right? And so that I just want to throw out there how much I appreciated those aspects of your story. Yeah. I'd like to just go into a little bit about just statistically, we know that I think currently that the numbers are like 1 in 3 women are sexually abused or assaulted in some way or another by the time that they reach adulthood. And I think the numbers currently are somewhere between 1 in 5 to 1 in 7 men. And the men's statistics tend to be a little bit more up in the air, and from my understanding, due to just the taboo nature of men being able to state that what happened to them was a sexual assault, because I think men have a different type of pressure put on them that they should want sexual advance or that they should somehow be, you know, it makes them more steadily if they've had sexual experience. There's some really damaging cultural messages for men as well when it comes to sexual abuse. So we don't, I think we're less sure of how common this is for men in their lives from a statistics standpoint. I also want to just throw out some of these terms and what do these things mean? Because I know a lot of times when I'm working with clients, they'll say, well, I wasn't raped because, you know, he didn't put his penis inside of me, you know, it was just his finger, or it was, you know, so people will not necessarily understand what these terms mean and therefore minimize the impact that it's had on them or feel badly. Like, I shouldn't have such a problem with this because I wasn't really raped. You somewhat did this with your story of the boy, the young man, at BYU, right? Well, like, you know, I wasn't, you know, he stopped and I, you know, my clothes were still on, so I shouldn't, thank goodness. I mean, yes, it could have been much worse, and you're absolutely right about that, but that doesn't necessarily make it a less traumatic event for you, right? And so these are, I think, really important things that any type of unwanted sexual advance or happening is considered sexual assault, and that rape in particular is, I think, defined differently legally for different states, depending on where you might live, especially here in the United States. But the way that most of us in the mental health profession would define that is that any type of penetration that with either a penis or other instruments, like, you know, bottles or sticks or fingers or whatever, that can be perpetrated into the vagina, anus, or mouth, you know, so any type of thing. So that would be kind of the official definition of rape. And sexual assault in general is much broader than that. So even if your, you know, clothes don't come off, like, you were obviously sexually assaulted by this man in the truck, just by his words, you know, when he says to you, you know, what panties are you wearing, or show me your panties, that in of itself is a sexual assault that's unwanted in your situation. Now, if it's flirtatious and if it's consensual, that's different. You know, you can have conversations like that are fun, but not necessarily in that setting. You know, he didn't test the waters to see if that would be an appropriate thing to be saying, right? Like, yeah. Would you like to be my girlfriend? Or would you like to...
Would you like to get out of the car?
Yeah. Would you like to kiss me first before I say something like that? Or, you know, or something more appropriate, right? Versus just jumping into that and then on top of it, locking you in. And that's a very different scenario than normal, what we'd call normal kind of boyfriend-girlfriend flirtations.
Right.
So is there anything that you would add to that, or the importance of understanding and not minimizing your own experiences due to whatever actually happened versus how it made you feel?
You know, I did a lot of research about, like, okay, what's the legal definition of rape in Utah? Because I was like, well, my whole life I've been, my parents have been like, don't be so dramatic. My parents are very subdued people, and I am not, which really genetically, I'm not sure how that worked out, but I've always been very intense. And so I started thinking about these things, and I was like, I don't want to call it rape if it isn't rape. Also, I remember when I was in second grade, my mom was a counselor with a rape crisis team. And that was the first time I heard the word, and I was like, what's rape? And she was like, well, rape is when a man, usually a man, forces usually a woman, but really any two people. Actually, she probably was man and woman. Let's be honest. It was the 80s. Anyway, you know, she's like, it's when someone forces someone else to have sex with them. And I was like, oh, well, what's sex? And so she gave me I'm so glad my kids haven't asked me this, but she gave me the very technical, you know, she's like, well, it's when a man puts his penis into a woman and ejaculates. And I was like, what's ejaculation? And anyway, by the time it was done, I was like, so basically rape is when a guy pees in you. This is a terrible thing. So, and it was a terrible enough thing that when it happened, my mom would drop everything she was doing and go to the hospital to help the woman. And so when I started maybe using the word, I was like, I want to make sure I'm using this right, because I don't want to be overly dramatic. I don't want to be inaccurate. I don't want to, I don't want to detract from the pain of the people who this has actually happened to. And then when I looked at the legal definition for the state that I'm in, and I went, oh no, it legally happened to me. I couldn't minimize it any longer. And I wonder if maybe that's, I mean, I know for me that part of the hesitation was not knowing the definition. Like, it made it, I couldn't pretend that it wasn't horrible any longer. And maybe for some people, that's why they get so caught up on the terminology. They're trying to define it so specifically, maybe just to make it a little bit less awful, but I don't know.
No, I think that's a very common thing. And one thing that I try to point out to people is if sexual, advances of any sort are producing discomfort or fear, and especially the concept of adrenaline running through our system, which is a fear response, that falls into the trauma experience, right? And then, of course, this is complicated a little bit further with, like you had mentioned briefly, what if part of me liked it? Right. Yeah. So like there's this attention that's being given by somebody that I admire or like or love, you know, if it's a family member or like a beloved teacher, kind of like what you're describing. And so then that becomes even infinitesimally more confusing as far as that piece of, well, maybe I did, you know, invite this in some ways, or maybe I had an orgasmic response, right, to some type of assault. And so how can I say that I didn't want it when my body responded with pleasure, right? So you can see how easily this becomes extremely confusing and difficult to navigate on an individual basis. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about, so now what, right? Well, and even before I go there, I thought it's very, very ironic that here your mother, I didn't know this, that your mother was part of this kind of support network for victims of rape and being so helpful to others, and yet under you know, your family culture, you're not able to get that type of validation for what happened to you. That's a pretty ironic kind of tragic piece of the story here.
Yeah, I have not reconciled that yet. But for me, there's been a real battle feeling like I deserve to heal from this. And, you know, I'm sure that my mom didn't intend for it to be this way, but watching her reach out to help other people heal and not to me, it was really, it just informed so much somehow. You know, and at that point I wasn't remembering what had happened at church, but I very clearly remembered what was happening with my cousin. And I still don't understand why she was willing to sacrifice so much to help strangers, which I think is a beautiful, noble thing. And I hope that everybody who goes to the hospital to have a rape kit performed or whatever, I hope that everybody who goes through that has someone meet them there. I imagine that that's a very meaningful thing. But then, you know, why couldn't that go the other way? I don't understand that.
And I think this speaks to the complications even within family systems, you know, as they deal with tragedy and trauma. It's many times so much easier to do that from a distance than in your own space. And not to excuse that behavior, but it's really interesting that's also part of the healing that needs to take place probably in your story. And
you can excuse it. I'm okay with that. You know, I look at the two adults that I told and I love them. I do. And I really think that they were doing the best that they could. And I really, really wish that they had done the thing they didn't think they could do. Like I look at them and I look at my own children and I think, okay, I am sure that hearing something like that from a child, I'm sure that your first response is, I don't know what to do, and I don't want to deal with this. And I don't know if I am strong enough to deal with this. But I really, 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 really wish that someone would have been willing to jump off that cliff and been like, okay, I don't think I'm strong enough for this. And we will figure it out anyway. I think that would have been, well, I think it would have made an immeasurable difference. You don't have to understand, but you have, you know, I mean, these people that did nothing are not bad people. They are good people who were just as confused as I was, but they were the grown-ups. And if you're going to be a grown-up, you kind of have to give up the luxury. It's not right to make the kid do that alone.
Yeah, and this is exactly right, is that the people that often fail us are the people that also build us up. You know, it's not black and white. These are complicated relationships with lots of good and bad in them. And as parents, I think most of us would understand that we fail our children often.
Yeah.
But this is something that I think is so important to educate ourselves on so that we don't fail our children in this particular way, so that we are prepared. Even with what you're saying, with statements like, okay, I don't know what to do right now, you know, but we're going to work on this together, or give me some time and we're going to figure this out, you know, or you don't have to have all the answers in that moment of uncertainty or fear, or, you know, not like you're saying, not knowing what to do next. But yeah, these are really important things for us to educate ourselves on as parents and grandparents and aunts and teachers, because it's not always your parents that you go to.
Yeah.
Sometimes even the parents are the perpetrators themselves. So, which is a whole nother complicated issue and very well illustrated in your examples. Every single one of your examples, this was not a stranger.
Right.
This was somebody that either was in your family system or in your community system, or, you know, somebody that it wasn't like you were knocked over the head and raped by somebody you didn't know, you know, this is, and that's tends to be the case, that is more likely that this will happen with somebody that you know versus somebody you don't.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, moving to the subject of, you know, now what? It seems like you're pretty early on in the process of kind of, you know, facing this aspect of your life. And it sounds like you have mentioned a therapist. So you've gotten yourself some professional help in regards to some of this. And it sounds like even before dealing with this, you were already in therapy for probably other issues. So what have you learned so far as, you know, some of the things that are natural and normal to have to work through, such as grieving and anger? You mentioned being angry and, you know, and even sexual healing. And what are some of your thoughts and ideas about, you know, as you yourself and as other women or men who might be listening to this start this type of a journey, what are some steps that can be taken to start moving in the right direction?
Oh boy.
Well, this is
really
probably more my job than your job.
this answer is probably going to illustrate that. I am a really, really, really big believer in finding a therapist that you like. Figure out how to pay for it later. I'm sure that as a profession, you're so glad I said that.
Yeah.
but I just, the whole idea of normal and healthy, and I wouldn't know normal and healthy if it hit me, right? Like, I really don't. I'm actually not very often willing to be angry, so it's kind of a big deal that I did that today. Yay. Yeah, I think I am a big, big, big believer in a therapist that you like. If you don't like them, go find another one. That's okay. It doesn't mean the therapist is a bad person. It doesn't mean you're a bad person. It just means it's not the right fit. I think telling my husband has been just so hard. So hard. I think I would have preferred if it had occurred to me to like sign a form with my therapist and be like, here, just tell him. Because, you know, this affects my husband too. And in the interest of a good relationship, I've tried to be open with him. But sometimes I just don't want to say it again, you know, or, you know, how do you bring that up? Hey, honey, let's talk about, no, like this is not a, there's not a good way to bring it up. There's not like, maybe I just didn't look hard enough, but there's not like a script online for how to have this conversation.
Right.
You know, just a couple weeks ago, someone asked me about some aspect of, I mean, so much has changed. It's just crazy. So much has changed in the last year that I'm kind of surprised my head hasn't spun off yet. Someone asked me about it and I told them, and my husband looked at me and he goes, I didn't know that. And I felt so bad. I was like, oh honey, I'm sorry. I'm not trying to keep a secret from you. can't keep track. Like, you know, he's just so respectful and he never asks, and I can't keep track of what I've told him and what I've been like, I don't want to talk about that yet. You know, so I don't know what anyone should do. If I figure out what I should do, that'll be a major accomplishment.
Right. Well, I think that you start off with a good suggestion, and that is that it is my strong belief that no one should have to figure this out on their own. That it's too hard of a thing, and it's whether it's a professional or a trusted teacher or some type of ecclesiastical leader. I mean, obviously the professional's trained to work in these types of issues, so you may not get the same type or appropriate support, you know, that you would need from some other well-meaning people in your life. So my first thought is professionals, but some people aren't comfortable with that. And so I would, you know, just say anybody in your life who is trusting and who will take you seriously and who will believe you and who will, you know, to your point, put the blame squarely on the perpetrator is a good place to start. And yeah, and spouses, that's a difficult thing to talk about because, of course, I've heard many people tell me, well, now I feel like not only am I dealing with this, but now I've got to help my spouse deal with it too. You know?
Right? So, yes. Right? And it's not that you have a needy spouse. It's just, you're like, oh crap, I brought this into their life and now I have to clean it up.
Yeah. So there's some sense of responsibility, like, you know, and so it's complicated. I understand those feelings. And of course, then the spouse is mortified because I'm like, well, I don't want you to take care of me, you know, but obviously they're having protective responses and hurtful responses and they're affected by these stories. And, yeah, so it does. It just becomes a difficult thing to start knowing how to navigate. And oftentimes I encourage spouses to be part of the treatment process as well. You know, not that they need to necessarily come to every session or so, but just have some couple sessions where you can have a space to talk about these kinds of issues with somebody who can help you negotiate those issues together. So those are good things. And I think that one other thing I would talk about is understanding that this is a process and it's very hard to define things like normal or it's very hard to define things like healing even, you know, like when am I going to know that I'm healed from this? That's very difficult to define. And that can look really differently for different people. Forgiveness is another huge kind of disaster of a term, to put it lightly, as far as how people think that should look like and whether or not it should be part of a treatment protocol. So, you know, so it is, it's complicated. It takes time, but it's worth it. You know, I think it's worth giving yourself the deserved attention that you need to, you know, take another look at how these traumatic events have affected your life and your relationships with other people. And limit setting, you know, like you talked about in your Relief Society class, you know, that it's okay to set limits and boundaries with certain aspects of your life. And you even mentioned taking a hiatus from church because right now church isn't helping you feel safe. And these are really complicated things for members of the church to figure out. What does this mean for my faith? Or what does this mean for my activity? Or I'm not doing my part, you know, or
my salvation. I mean, it goes really deep.
Right. Right. So these are things that I think, again, there's no one size fits all. And what works for one person isn't going to work for another person. And one thing that I'll just say right now, even before we end this whole podcast, is I will be monitoring the comments on this podcast very carefully. I'm usually pretty open to letting people disagree with me. And, you know, I don't care about that. I like to be challenged and I like hearing other people's ideas, but I will not allow for you to be mistreated or challenged or blamed in any way, shape, or form on this. So just to let my audience know that comments for this particular podcast will be very heavily moderated.
Okay, Chelsea. So let's start meandering towards, I guess, Mormonism when it comes to dealing with sexual assault and sexual abuse and all the different kinds of things that we've been talking about. Because obviously these things happen within the construct of Mormonism, whether it's that you have a Mormon perpetrator, like in your case, or you have, like a lot of times bishops and relief site presidents are first responders to these types of issues. Like people trust them, you know, with this type of information first, or young women's leader, or young men's leader, things of that nature. There's youth leaders who have been perpetrators in our church. We're not immune to that. You know, so there's lots of complicated things as far as how spirituality and messages at church can be interpreted, and whether or not you find healing or further re-traumatization in your church environment or spiritual environment. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I'd like to kind of get your perspectives, and maybe you can share personally how you were affected spiritually by things at church. But I'd also like to keep the conversation on not only are there negative aspects, but what positive aspects, and because I think there's a lot of really well-intentioned people at church who want to help and many times don't know how to help or don't know how their messages may be coming across. So let's start there.
Okay. I think, I mean, the only time I've ever told a church leader would be just very recently. And the only reason I told my bishop was because I wasn't coming to church anymore. because I live so close to BYU, we have, my ward is really odd in that we have about 70% turnover. Well, like a minimum of 70% turnover every year, because 70% of our ward is BYU students. And so when someone who is long-term stops coming, it gets noticed. And so, you know, I was like, well, I'm not coming because of this. And my bishop has been really, really great. He's just been like, okay, we want to help. So what is helpful? And I've said, okay, well, it's helpful for me to not come. And he said, you know, and he was like, okay, can we bring you the sacrament? And I said, no, I don't want that. And he was like, okay. Is it okay if your home teachers still come? And I was like, yeah, it's okay. That's okay. And, you know, he's contacted me every, you know, 5 weeks or so and just been like, how are you doing? So it's been really great because I haven't felt pressure, but at the same time, I haven't felt forgotten. And that's been really great. I really appreciate, you know, cause he's not a therapist. He's a businessman. And I'm sure that he was like, ah, crap, now what? And so that's been really great, where he's let me be in charge and just kind of been sort of backup.
And it sounds like he tried to offer some creative solutions, or, you know, like there's different things that we can do here, and kind of allowing you to decide whether or not those would be helpful for you.
Yeah. Yeah. He did a really good job, and it wasn't, well, you have to do it this way. It was, okay, what do you want to do?
Can you go into a little bit, and I know you mentioned this slightly before, but can you go into why church became a non-safe place for you as you're starting to delve into these things deeper for yourself?
Sure. I am a baby person, very much. I love babies. And usually when I go to church, I would pick up somebody's baby and be like, here, you can have the hour off. And I would just, you know, because I like it. But really what happened, it was a Sunday before Christmas. And all of my friends with babies were gone. They were all visiting family, or they were all, they were just gone for Christmas. And all of a sudden I was sitting there without a baby to distract myself. And I just started having flashbacks, and because before, when I had been remembering things, I had remembered them very intellectually or else very physically. There had never been an emotional component to it. And then all of a sudden I was sitting in this church and all of the emotions came back, and it was, I had to leave. I was like, I have to leave right now. I'm like, it's the Sunday before Christmas. This is like the week when everyone goes to church. I have to get out. And I went home and I just sobbed for the whole rest of the block. So like 2.5 hours of sobbing. And I was like, okay, I can't, I have never felt good in a church building ever that I can remember. And I have always looked for a reason. I was like, is it the doctrine? Is it the people? Am I not being honest about whether or not I've sinned? Like, I've gone through every possible explanation for why I have never felt comfortable in a church, in a Mormon church building. And frankly, I am horrible when I get ready for church. I am mean to people. I am so on edge. Like, the only way I can get myself to church is if that is the only thing I have to do. If I have to get breakfast for my kids, if I have to give someone an opinion on their shoes, like, forget it. I can't do that. I am so tense about just getting there. And I always have been. And I'm like, what is the problem here? Something is broken. And then all of a sudden on that day, I was like, all right, this is the problem. This is what is broke. I am what is broken here. But I've never felt safe.
And I'm assuming your assumption is that, I mean, this is where the original assault took place, was in a church setting, and yeah, that it has something to do with that. I'm assuming that's what the conclusion you've come to.
Yeah. And it's, you know, and it's not just the building it happened in. Like, all the Mormon buildings feel the same to me. And I suspect they feel the same to everybody. It's just that I think for most people, it's like a welcoming thing. And for me, it's like, this is not safe. This is not safe. They do not want you here. You are not right. This is not a, you cannot be here. And finally I was like, all right, I'm not. So I decided to stop going to church at Christmas time. And about a month later, my bishop was like, hey, will you come meet with me? I just want to see how things are going. And I was like, yeah, I will. And I was like, this is a good chance to try going back. It'll be a Wednesday night. I'll just try it. And between parking in the parking lot and walking to his office, I was crying hysterically. I was like, I can't do this. I can't come back. And he said, okay, I won't ask you to. And then the next time he wanted to meet, you know, his secretary emailed and said, hey, the bishop would like to meet with you. And I emailed back and I said, that's great. I need it to be in my home. And my bishop was like, awesome. Great. I will come to you. I will not ask you to come back. So I can't right now. I don't go to Relief Society activities because I can't handle being in the building. I fall apart, and it is so stressful, and I am so looking for the warning sign. Even if I don't think it, like, even if I'm like, no, this is not good. Like, it doesn't matter.
Well, there's a lot of things I like about what you're saying. I mean, obviously the first thing that I'm so encouraged by is your bishop's response, you know, just his flexibility and his willingness to kind of meet you where you are, you know, which I think is so important, as part of this kind of safety healing that you're needing to go through. And I think one of the first things that we talk about, and as far as treatment is concerned, is helping victims find places where they feel safe, you know, because safety is such the core, you know, issue, which of course then lends to fear and anxiety and, you know, all these kind of triggering things that you're mentioning. So that sounds like, you know, you are helping yourself find safety by creating appropriate boundaries, and those in your community are respecting that.
Yeah. My bishop is doing a really great job. I feel like for a lot of, well, I don't know. I feel like in this area and maybe other areas, but I live here, there can be a really big emphasis on numbers. And with my bishop, I don't feel like a number. I feel like a person. And I feel like whatever pressure comes from higher up to get the numbers up, he's not going to forget that I'm a person. And that's, I mean, I cannot speak highly enough of him and how much I appreciate. Yeah, I just think that's so Christ-like of him. And he's a really great guy. I feel really lucky.
Well, and I think just even from a cultural perspective, you know, a lot of people might be uncomfortable with, I mean, when people think about, okay, how do you solve a problem in your life, you know, or how do you get better? Some of the first things you're going to hear is, well, go to church regularly, right? Read your scriptures and make sure you're praying on a regular basis. And, you know, so those are kind of the tools that we have used. And for a lot of people, those things are really significant. I'm not trying to minimize those things because they can be very part of the healing process. But when we need to veer dramatically from that, you know, and I've worked with a lot of people where scriptures are what's triggering, right? Or they go through phases where praying brings on a panic attack, right? Or so some of these spiritual tools are not always helpful. And I think as a culture, we have a really hard time with that. Like, how can a gospel principle not be helpful to you, right?
Yeah.
And so then there's this discomfort or this challenge to the person who's relating these experiences that well, you're either not doing it right or you need to do it more, even though it's uncomfortable, right? Or like you're saying, this pressure. And that's why I'm finding your bishop's approach so wonderfully insightful, you know, as far as tuning into what somebody who's under his, you know, kind of ecclesiastical care, that he's tuning into your needs in that way.
Yeah.
And being flexible with our theology in a sense, right? Okay, well, good. So is there anything in particular that you feel like, as far as, you know, the messages that you grew up hearing, or the way that you interpreted doctrine or theological teachings, are there things there that are helpful? Are there things there that help you kind of cognitively make sense of things? Or on the other hand, are there things that are damaging or not helpful to you? And that's probably a pretty broad question. but is there anything that comes to mind in particular when I bring that subject up?
Well, you know, I'm trying really hard to think of helpful things. And I think in fairness to the religion, everything has been filtered through like this subconscious, yes, but this happened, right? So yeah, there's really nothing that has been really healing for me. Are you okay if I go off on kind of a little bit of a tangent here?
Yes.
Okay. You can always edit it out later if you like, but the worst place for me, you know, it's you grow up and it's all about getting to the temple and what happens in the temple, and the temple is the house of God on earth, and it's this wonderful, beautiful experience, you know. So you grow up with that as your goal, like that's where I'm trying to get to. I have been invited to leave the temple 3 times. 3 different times, 2 different temples, 3 different occasions, 3 different temple workers have invited me to leave. And so I decided.
What do you mean by invited to leave?
I mean, come up to me and been like, sister, this is, you know, you are not reverent enough. This is a place for reverence. You need to leave.
And what were you doing that wasn't reverent enough, if you don't mind me asking?
No, I don't mind you asking.
Jumping jacks or what are you doing?
Okay, well, the one time that makes sense. The one time that it happened, my brother's fiance had just come through the temple for the first time, and I was so excited because, you know, she's an only child, and she's like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I get to have sisters, and I love her, and I was like, oh my gosh, I mean, I love my brother, but he totally scored a 10. Like, I was so excited that he got to marry her, and she was going to be my sister, and we were probably really loud. It was a joyful noise, but apparently okay, I was probably very loud. There was like hugging and loud happiness, loud joy. And okay, I can see how that one was detracting from other people.
But instead of coming to you and saying, you know, sisters, remember to be reverent, there was an actual sisters, you need to leave.
There, to me, not to her, because she was the new bride, and she was going to go spend time with her fiance, and but it was this is not appropriate for the temple. You need to leave. And I was like, I'm being happy. What is your problem? Like, it just seemed very odd to me. I was like, seriously? I mean, we're sitting here celebrating the fact that we're going to be we're going to be family forever. And this bothered. Okay. All right. Well, I'll just leave. We're going to go out to dinner after this. I'll just leave. But in that instance, they're actually, okay. So I'm a dancer. It's my job. It's who I am. It's built into my body. And when I get happy, I get demonstrably happy. I was probably doing a very small jumping up and down happy dance while we hugged. So in that instance, all right, yes. I completely disagree with the whole concept of like, joy has to be subdued, but that's okay. I could totally see how maybe I was distracting to other people. And that in that case, you know, it would have been a little bit more compassionate to be like, this is so exciting. Would you guys like to come into this room? Right. That would maybe have been a more compassionate take on that.
Or, I mean, I've been hushed, you know, in church lobbies all the time because we get to talking, you know, and we forget that there's another ward meeting, you know,
yeah.
while we're giggling or talking, and people come and say, oh, we can kind of hear you guys. You know, oh, I'm sorry. You know, we kind of, you know, kind of quiet ourselves down because our level of consciousness at that level of what we're doing isn't super high. So I'm just kind of surprised that you weren't reminded versus leaving.
That's... No, it was a loving invitation to leave until I could be in line with the purpose of the temple, which I think is just beyond stupid. I was completely in line with the purpose of the temple. We were going to be sisters forever. But anyway, so that was the first time. That was not the first time. Anyway, that was one of the times. The other two times, I was by myself, and you know, I was feeling very happy, and my foot was jiggling pretty, you know, I mean, like I said, I'm a dancer. I wasn't doing high kicks in the middle of the temple or anything, but like my foot was jiggling, or I was having like a, you know, I was just kind of happy and kind of, you know, I was sitting still, but I was maybe a little bit of a bobblehead, but no big deal. Right. Like, but both times a temple worker would come up and be like, sister, this is not reverent. You need to leave. And the third time it happened, I was like, that's it. I'm not coming back. If there's not space, like this is something that I've been taught is the closest thing to heaven on earth. And three times now I have been specifically told my demonstration of happiness and the way that I feel joy is not welcome there. I'm not coming back. I'm not. I don't think I will. And I actually, I'm not going back. Because, reminders to be reverent are unreasonably hurtful to me. And there's no way that anybody could know that. There is no way that anybody is going to know, oh, well, you know, the man that held her down reminded her she had to be reverent. I understand that. But then to be like, okay, well, like it just, there is no place for me there. This is not like, oh, well, this one temple has this weird policy. This has happened in more than one temple. I'm like, no, if there's not a place for me in your temple, I'm not going to try to change. Because that doesn't make me a better person. That makes me feel like I'm wrong. And so that's probably the most dramatic example, but I have always felt wrong. You know, I grew up always knowing that I wanted to get a master's degree. And when I was in primary and young women's, well, a master's degree is okay if you don't get married, but you should get married and have your spouse and I always knew that that was going to be different, and I felt wrong for that. And I felt, you know, I've always hated fasting. Well, it turns out I have hypoglycemia. So, you know, I probably shouldn't be fasting anyway, but that hasn't stopped a number of people from being like, well, if you really had righteous desires, you would do it. I mean, just, on and on and on. And I remember when I was diagnosed with clinical depression when I was 15. And there were a number of really well-meaning people in my life who really wanted me to feel better. But they all said, you know, it's none of my business. I'm not prying. You don't need to tell me anything. But if you'll just repent, whatever it is that's making you feel bad, that will go away. You will be forgiven and you will be happy again. And I, you know, as I'm trying to figure out what's the problem here, I was like, no, I don't think I've done anything I need to repent of. And then when I finally did figure it out, I was like, no, I don't need to repent. My brain is not working right, but I have not sinned. And the whole concept of only sinners feel this bad, I mean, I'm really proud of myself that I at least had the common sense to be like, you are wrong. Instead of being like, well, am I sinning? Like, is this a punishment? No, it's not a punishment. It's horrible. And I wouldn't wish it upon anybody. But I got really tired of people being like, well, if you'll just repent, then you'll feel better. No, I promise. I have repented. Well, not anymore. But there was a point in my life where I repented of everything you could possibly repent of. And it didn't make anything better. Or, you know, there have been times when I've been like, okay, I need to be released from this calling. Either because there are things going on in my family that need my attention, or because I'm super depressed and all of my attention needs to be on not dying. And without fail, when I have gone and been like, I need to be released from this calling, I've been met with a lecture about how I'm expected to sacrifice for Zion, or the Lord gives us calling so that we can grow. Every time, nobody has ever looked at me and been like, okay, all right, this is what you need. Let's do this. And I mean, that's stupid. I mean, when I was the Laurel class president, and I'm dealing with this massive depression, and I'm trying to keep up this ridiculously high GPA, and I'm doing a pre-professional ballet training thing. So I'm dancing 35 hours a week, and I'm going to school full time. And, you know, I was like, I need to not be the Laurel president anymore. And that took a lot of courage for me to go to an adult priesthood leader and tell him what I needed. And then to have him be like, no, what you really need is this. That really took the wind out of my sails. And I was like, no, what I really need is to not be doing this calling right now. And even then they never released me. They just called an extra counselor. And I was like, at what point do you believe me? At what point do I get to say, this is my line, this is my limit? And really with this current bishop, this is the first time that has happened. And so I think, you know, and you're taught to never refuse a calling. And I have gotten over that. I have refused a couple at this point. You know, you're taught never refuse a calling, and every calling, you know, every sacrifice that you make is going to make you better. I don't believe that. I mean, sure, for some people, okay, great. But for me, I sacrifice too much for other people. Like, when I'm able to draw a boundary, it's a big deal for me. And I want to be in a community that respects that and says, okay, I'm tired of other people telling me how much I can do or how much I should do or what the right choice. It just, does that make sense?
Anyway. Absolutely. I mean, I think this is one of the cultural issues that many of us are struggling with, because we kind of have, again, these principles that in general can be good, but unless we really apply them to individuals, right, and yeah, allow for that individual aspect of worship and what's healthy for that particular person, then we can make some really false assumptions about what everybody needs or doesn't need. And that can be really harmful and I think isolating and discouraging for so many of our members.
Yeah, and I really, really, really wish that people would stop saying every trial is for your good. I think that for some people, sure. Either that's what they genuinely believe or that gives them some kind of meaning. Okay, I don't want to take that away from you. And usually the people who are saying that are going through trials like, I didn't get into graduate school the first time I applied, which has happened to me. So I get that, right? Like, I'm not minimizing that pain. You know, and then they're like, but the next year I applied to this other school and it's been such a better fit for me. Okay, then that trial worked for your good. But could you open up your definition here and just look? I mean, could it occur to you that maybe someone in your audience has gone through something that was not for their... There is no way what I've gone through has been for my good. Because,
yeah,
I mean,
this is something that I think is really important for us to be talking about. And in fact, there was a quote from Eyring at just a few days ago at the General Women's Conference that I wanted to bring up with you, because and I'm going to paraphrase and probably mess it up here because I don't have it actually in front of me, but he said something along the lines of, you know, Heavenly Father has provided trials that are specifically made for you. You know, so in other words, you have this nice little package of trials that have been developed in some, I guess, trial factory or something that are exactly for what you need to progress in life and, you know, get to this point where you're going to, I don't know, according to our doctrine, you know, be able to move on to the progression of becoming a priestess and a goddess and, you know, all these things that we talk about, you know, in temple worship. So this has been highly a problematic thing for so many of my clients who have dealt with some type of sexual assault, that somehow sexual assault or rape or incest or abuse of any sort or type was made specifically for me to be able to learn and grow in the ways that I need to learn and grow. What are your thoughts about that?
I think it's just outright false. I really do. Because what kind of person was I in the first place that I would have needed that? Like, that doesn't make sense. How horrible of a human being would you have to be to need being raped as a 3-year-old to make you into a decent person? There is no way that I can wrap my brain around that. And there is no way that I can look at this and be like, oh, I'm a more compassionate person because this happened to me. No, I am a compassionate person because that is who I am. This is not some kind of deep spiritual gift that only the elite get. This is a horrible, horrible, horrible thing that breaks you in the deepest, most fundamental ways that I can possibly think of. And it's been 30 years. It's been 30 years. And I have still not managed to heal from this or to put the pieces back together. And how can that be to my good? I don't think that he ever thought that through. I don't think that he had ill intentions, but I don't think he has ever looked at me or someone in my position and really felt empathy for me. Anybody.
Yeah. Well, I think, I mean, this is where it gets tough, I think, for us to make sense of God theologically in general, because I think these types of issues come up under a lot of different themes. You know, like, if God is all powerful and omnipotent, for example, why doesn't he intervene, right, for people who are suffering kind of these unnecessary things, right? So it's one thing if, oh, I don't know, some awful person who's done some awful things needs to, you know, have some justice. That's one thing, right? But the tsunami, for example, right? I mean, like that wiped away, how many children did that wipe away? And just people who are good people, you know, just trying to live their lives. And So this comes up a lot, I think, in theological circles, is how do we make sense of an omnipotent God who has the power to intervene, supposedly, according to a lot of our theology, but doesn't? And I guess, and I just want your opinion on this, because this is something that I'm trying to grapple with a lot of my clients on, but we try to explore possibilities, you know, in therapy, and one of the things that I think is helpful, if you want to believe in a God, and if you want that spirituality, that type of spirituality in your life, I'm not sure it's super useful to believe in a God that had the power to stop your rape and didn't. Okay, so we do have some theological background in Mormonism that does talk about a limited God. Okay, so in other words, God himself or herself has to abide by the laws of, I don't know if we want to cut physics or, you know, like there's laws in the universe that even God has no control over. Right. And so, so that's a little bit different than this, you know, God that's going to come down and kind of part the Red Sea. Right. So we've got kind of these contradictory stories or even theologies, even in our own stuff. So my thought is, I mean, one of the things that I love about how I interpret Mormon theology is this whole metaphor of family systems, you know, and how we see ourselves as kind of like children of God and brothers and sisters. And then we've all been actually placed in these family units, you know, where we have to figure out a lot of things with each other. And as a parent myself, I make the choice to have a child knowing full well that that child will suffer, you know, and yet I still chose to be a parent. And I have a daughter and I have some boys. And, when I think about, you know, some of my fears as a parent, it kind of tunes into this, right? That I would be unable to protect them from this type of pain or assault, right? That they're going to go out into the world and I can teach them and guide them all day long, but I'm not going to necessarily be able to protect them from an assault of any kind, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Unless they're under my wing and I have a gun at my side. And even then, you know, they can wipe me out too. So again, there's just a lot of control that I do not have as a loving parent to protect them from experiencing the agency of other people. And I think this also falls in our theology. It's this concept of agency, and then that's a big piece of it's a law, right? It's a universal law, and the consequences of a God who would allow for agency, right? And so, so then I see my role as a parent and as a loving parent is that if and when those types of things would happen, what is in my control, and that is the comforting and healing piece of it. In other words, I would wrap that child in my arms and hold them and cry with them and, you know, try to find resources for them. And, you know, so in a sense, I guess I'm trying to push that concept onto our worshiping of a God who, when he says, you know, I will be by your side or I will protect you, that it's not always what we expect that protection might look like. And therefore, if you're going to continue in a belief of God, that you can worship somebody who you interpret as an ally and not as somebody who's been part of this abuse to begin with. Does that make any sense? I'm not even sure I'm saying that very well.
No, it does make sense to me. So the big,
Feel free to shut me up and completely like mess this idea. It's just something I'm trying to work with as far as working with members who have this idea that, well, I need to accept this because it's part of my trials and you know, God wanted me to, not that he wanted me necessarily to go through this, but it, you know, we go through bad things because in the end, therefore are good. And, you know, so again, I find these things and then they're crying in my office and telling me that they don't know how to pray to a God who would do this to them. And so these are the things that I'm trying to complicate or challenge people on, like, are there different ways that we could look at this? But, yeah. but feel free to tell me, you know, that doesn't work for you or, you know. Well,
I mean, I haven't prayed in a very, in, oh, like, I haven't prayed in months because I'm like, okay, you know what? I need, we need a time out. I've done this with my actual physical parents before, like when we disagree on things and been like, all right, let's just take a time out. I'll call you in a couple months.
And I love timeouts, by the way.
Yeah, timeouts are important, healing. Right?
Because they're temporary. They don't have to, you know, they're just like, I need space. They don't have to be forever, but it gives you that time to kind of rethink through things.
So God and I are taking a timeout right now because I tried just being like, all right, I don't believe in a God, but that does not ring true for me. I'm not sure I believe in a Mormon God either, but I definitely believe in a higher power and a higher good, and there's something better coming. I tried really hard not to because it didn't make any sense, and it just didn't. I didn't feel comfortable in my own skin, kind of. But the thing that has just really bothered me about God, you know, you hear these stories of miracles. You hear them all the time. And I live within walking distance of a very famous national blogger whose miracle has been just all over the news. And I would never, ever take that away from her. It is miraculous what's happened to her. And it's been horribly painful and horribly difficult. And I would never want to minimize that. But I look at that and I think, she got a miracle. She felt angels by her side helping her through the most horrific thing she could imagine. Why didn't I? You know, or you look at, you know, why was this person miraculously saved and I wasn't? And it's, you know, and then you bring these questions up in Sunday school. Well, why are some people saved and some people aren't? And the answers you get are always so... They're always assuming that the people who get the miracles are the ones in the classroom and the people who don't get miracles are the others because we're the chosen generation and we're from the house of Ephraim and we're part of the true church and we get the miracles and we have the priesthood power. And being the person in the room who didn't get the miracle, who not only didn't get a God to come in and stop it, but who also didn't get a God to come in and be like, all right, I'm just going to do a little miracle here. And there's this huge, long process of this horrific work that you have to do to get past this. And for your miracle, I'm going to shorten that process for you. I'm going to take you from point A to point B and just there. You don't have to do this walk anymore. Enough is enough. I don't get that miracle. Or, you know, and this is going to bring up, people are going to be like, well, it's because the healing is for your own good. No, it's not. I am not getting to a better place. I am trying to get to where I was when I was 3. If I could get to that level of trusting another human being, that would be amazing. And I could be 90 years old before I get to that. And then I'm still 87 years behind everybody else. Why do some people get miracles and I don't? And, you know, the most thought out answer I've ever gotten, and this came from a person who knows me pretty well. Nobody knows me really well. Like, I'm very careful to compartmentalize things. So, like, my husband knows almost the whole story, but not quite. And my therapist knows almost the whole story, but not quite. There is no person where I'm like, here, you can have the whole thing. Because I just don't trust anybody. But I was talking to someone that I do trust quite a bit. And they had known me for quite a while. And I was like, why don't I get a miracle? And the best answer they could give me was, because God knows you don't need one. And that's stupid too. Because A, I'm not any stronger than people who do get miracles. And B, yes, I do. Yes, I really, really, really do. And so I think...
And I think some other ways that people might respond to that is, well, you're not recognizing the miracles that are happening, right? That's another right. one that I hear a lot. Or with time, you'll be able to see that miracles were happening, you know. But again, that minimizes or dismisses kind of your current feelings, whether that's the case or not. And who knows? Yeah. We don't know. And so I'm not sure that there's any answer to that that's better than that I don't know.
Why can't it be like, but nobody says I don't know, because we can't not know, because we have the fullness of the gospel. And you guys, there's a lot of pressure with that. If this is like the fullness of the gospel and this is Jesus's church on earth, then it's not okay for us to not know. Nobody ever gets up and says, I don't know. We're not, you know, we're told we had to get up on fast and testimony meeting and talk about what we know. Why can't we talk about what we don't know? Why is that not okay? Because there's an awful lot that I don't know.
Right. And that these answers that we've come up with are not, they're not correctly or adequately giving you the knowledge that you need.
I've given up on knowledge. At this point, I would just like to be in a room of people who don't need me to be anything. And that might be asking a lot of human beings in general, but you know, I would just like to, I'm so tired of going to church and feeling like I'm needed. And I understand that people mean well, but I don't want you to need me to do my visiting teaching. I don't want you to need me to come do my calling. I don't want you to need anything from me, because right now I need a lot from you. And I need to not be contributing right now. And I need to not be self-sufficient for a while. Like, deeply not self-sufficient. There are days when, I mean, my poor kids have had more fast food in the last 2 years than they have in the whole rest of their lives up to that point. Because for reasons, I don't understand why this is so hard. I don't understand why remembering things makes me so physically tired that I cannot go to the store and buy bread and peanut butter. But I can't.
Yeah.
It's such a culture that stresses self-reliance and, you know, oh, the best way to feel better is to go serve someone else. Sometimes, sure, yeah. Sometimes you can't. And I don't hear anybody saying, no, you can't right now. And that's okay too. I get a lot of preaching about, you know, about, well, forget yourself and get to work. No, I really need to not forget myself. There needs to be, and I understand, you know, I'm sure that most of this is coming from people who think this is deeply uncomfortable for them. And I would like to get to the point where I can have compassion for that. But right now, I kind of don't care. I don't care if this is hard for you. If it's hard for you to hear about, think about how hard it is for me to live through. And people want quick solutions. And they want, okay, well, you've been in therapy for this long now, so you're fine, right? No, I'm not fine. Well, you're going to be fine soon, right? I don't know. Well, maybe you should work on that question next. When are you going to be okay? I don't know. And do you really need me to be okay? Am I only welcome here if I'm okay? Because what if I don't get to that point? What if I am never okay? I mean, it was hard enough to look at my husband, because I was a wife who got all kinds of crap done. I was the most productive lady ever. Because I had to be. I had to stay distracted. And boy, I got a lot of stuff done. I get nothing done now. I get nothing done. And my poor husband is doing huge amounts of work. And he's not complaining at all, because he's an amazing guy. But it was really hard to look at my husband, who is picking up a ton of slack, and being like, would you stick around if it doesn't get better? Will you cover for me if I can't ever get back to the person I used to be. And I, you know, and then to go to a church where nobody is giving a fraction of what my husband did. And that's probably really appropriate. But I feel like there are so many people who are just waiting. They're like, okay, come on, Sister Weidman, we've been really patient with you. We need, you know, come on. You're, you know, there's like a dozen people in my ward between the ages of 30 and 65. I'm not kidding. It's a weird demographic. So people my age are really needed because there's the young newlyweds who need help and there's the old people who need help. And, you know, come on, Sister Weidman, we need you back. And do you want me? Even if I can't ever do that? You know, I never felt like a piece of chewed gum because of the assaults. For some reason, I was just like, I've always known. Nope. There's a big difference between, like, choosing to live the law of chastity and having someone take that from you. But I feel like a piece of chewed gum because I can't do everything that I used to be able to do. And I don't feel like that's welcome. I don't feel like there's space to be broken. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It's a culture of, you know, come on, your pioneer ancestors walked across the plains and then built a house and look at what we've created from nothing. And we are can-do people. But I'm not. I'm not right now. And I think every time I've pretended that I was just really faking it. And is it okay if I'm never one of those people again? Can you have space for me? Can you help me when I need help? Even if you know I might not ever pay back into the system everything I take out. And I don't know. I don't know if there's space for me to be that needy.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Mental Health. To discuss this episode, please check us out at mormonmentalhealth.org. To keep the podcast alive, please consider a donation today, again, at mormonmentalhealth.org. Logo was provided by Daniel Singer. Music was generously donated by Lower Lights. Please check them out at thelowerlights.com. And thanks for listening.
Over last tempestuous sea, chart and compass came from thee. Jesus saved.